Hi, I am the girl who keeps seeing a ghost in her television set, Danielle Radford.
I'm the displaced neighbor hiding under your stairs, Megan Rosati.
Welcome to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, a Stage 13 original series that is an immersion into the unique worlds created by each episode of the hit anthology series on the CW and Netflix.
In each episode of our podcast, we sit down with the Two Sentence Horror Stories creators, as well as celebrity guests and social activists, to deep dive into the social and cultural issues explored on the cult series
and the carefully intricate craft that went into the making of each episode.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast. Danielle, what's new? Is Mercury still in retrograde? Has the world stopped being on fire? How are you doing today?
Well, Mercury is still in Gatorade. I am lucky enough that I don't have stairs in my apartment. I have always been terrified of them since that movie came out. And also, I do want to say that was one of the first horror movies where I was like, oh, this is like super black. That's cool.
Yeah.
It was a super black horror movie. It was really cool.
Today, we are discussing the episode Erased, where a woman is determined to save her home and her family's rich Hawaiian culture from being forgotten.
What do you want, Owen?
The contract Sanford Development offered for both your homes expires at midnight tonight.
You said we're not taking it.
Which is why Sanford is sweetening the deal.
We don't want your botched money. I'm going home. Call you later, Leigh. She's right. Your money's cursed. Anything used to tear down a community has to be.
Leilani, I know you don't believe me, but I respect what you're trying to do. But all this is going to be high-rises and multiplexes.
You can check out this full episode on the CW and the CW app. Today on the podcast, we'll be discussing gentrification and the United States' track record toward the treatment of Native Hawaiians.
Joining our conversation today, we have the star of Erased, Mapuana Makia.
Mapuana Makia is an accomplished director, actor, and writer who has appeared on Hawaii Five-0 and How to Get Away with Murder. And later on in the show, we'll be joined by filmmaker, writer, director, and film critic, April Wolf.
April co-wrote the 2019 Black Christmas remake and has appeared in the 2021 horror documentary, Behind the Monsters. First off, Mapuana Makia. Mapuana, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We are super excited. We loved the episode. We loved all the work that you did in the episode. We cannot wait to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much. Hi. Nice to be here.
Hi, we are so excited to talk to you, and I'm personally super excited to talk to you. For our podcast listeners, I actually know Mapuana personally. She used to live next door to my good friend, and I saw her actor journey close up before she moved to Canada. So this is extra special because I get to interview somebody I already know and like. So, Mapuana, you are the first actor we've had on the podcast.
I feel very fortunate for that. Thank you very, very, very much.
We are so excited. So before we get into your episode, we'd really love to learn what brought you into the world of acting.
What brought me into the world of acting, strangely enough, I was sitting in a big cafeteria. I was in kindergarten, and they brought us all into this assembly. And then two people got on stage and started acting, and I had no idea what it was. I just knew that I wanted to like do it, and I wanted to jump on stage, and I didn't understand why everyone else didn't want to jump on stage with them. And so it was just this thing, like, I don't know what it is, but I know I want to do it.
Yeah.
And then it sort of, it started really early. And then
so you've always had the bug. So what brought you, because I met you in Los Angeles, where a lot of up and coming actors go. So what brought you to the city initially?
Well, it was either Los Angeles or New York. Then I was like, being from Hawaii, I don't know how to do anything with cold weather at all. And now I'm in Vancouver. So
Mainland is rough, yo.
Mainland is rough. Like, I'm used to like 80% humidity at all times, like 80 degree weather. So
and trade winds if it is hot.
Yeah. So Los Angeles just seemed more like the easier transition.
Yeah.
I would later find out that there were a lot of different things that I'd have to learn about the culture of Los Angeles beyond weather. But
the sunshine is the easiest part, turns out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Easiest part.
Also, it's very dry for us. Like, I think a lot of people who follow me know this. So I used to live in Hawaii, and then I'm also like from Seattle and in like that kind of BC-ish area. The dryness is not great for us, like sea level gals. Like, it's not good. It's not good.
I was like, why is my entire body just peeling? I couldn't figure it out for the first year of my life. So anyway, long story short, that's sort of how I got into acting. And then it led me to the next thing of being like, well, if you're going to be serious about this, and I was, you know, I was just sort of following my love for acting and wanting to see about how to keep doing it. And I'm very, very, very fortunate that about 15 years later, we are talking about an episode I'm in. So,
I was telling Mapu before we started recording, I brought a strong big sister energy to this episode because when you are personally invested in somebody's performer journey and then you get to see them freaking kill it, like and she killed it.
Thank you.
I was really excited to see you on screen.
I appreciate it. I'm tearing up a little bit.
No, I love it. Go with it. Sacrifice your emotions for our audience.
Okay, will do. It always surprises me when I do it. I'm like, oh, here I go. But yeah, thank you so much.
I am so in love with your journey and with acting because like everyone, like we all know how that hard this is. And to get to a point where you actually get to like, now you're doing horror. Was Two Sentence Horror Stories your first time getting into horror? Tell me about it.
It was my very, very first time. And I remember doing the audition and then getting the job and then getting into makeup, getting into hair, and then realizing, oh my gosh, I'm going to do a lot of running and crying in the next week.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't dawn on me. And then they're like, okay, now you're going to run to the door and you're going to be terrified out of your mind. I was like, oh, this is going to be my whole week.
Yeah.
My cardio wasn't up for it, but I feel like it added to the character.
What people don't realize about genre acting is it's a very physical experience.
It's so physical.
Like,
it's like, because, you know, people watch a lot of drama and drama is very much like words, words, words. Now you words. Now I hit a wall. And then those are the ends of the words. And it's like genre is very much like, oh, now I'm running.
And
it doesn't matter if you're on if you're a predator or prey. It's like,
yes.
Oh, I'm running, and sometimes I'm running in 100 pounds of stuff. You don't know like what it's going to be.
There were so many different factors too. But you know, the surprising part that I found about it that was so much fun was leaning into just like the childlike fun of horror, and instead of me having to be like go into this place, I just like. It was just fun, like be a kid, have fun. And it was also really helpful because I had two kids on set.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, between takes had to be like, I'm not really scared. So if, you know what I mean? Because I didn't want to scare them.
Yeah.
And then I didn't. So it was that delicate balance of being like, we're just playing. Yeah. And then it kind of kicked into my head that I was like, yeah, we're just playing. We're having a good time. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it became really joyful to do horror.
Yeah.
Which is really strange to, but that's what my experience was.
I love that one. My parents were like, why do you do horror? I'm like, because it's so fun. Like people who are outside of it see the scary, you know, dramatic, tension-filled elements of it. But when you're within it, it feels like so much playing, right? Like you're doing, there's no real life stakes. Like you're disappearing limb by limb. So if you can imaginatively inhabit that place, it can be really fun.
It was really fun.
Oh, I love that. I love like the joyful aspect of like, this is play. And I feel like a lot of times when we talk about actors, it's always like, this is how I get into character. And like, this is, you know, my technique. And it's like, no, sometimes it's just like you get to play, you know?
You get to play.
And that's so dope.
You get to not adult for a second. Which is, for one second.
So what wound up drawing you to the show and specifically like this story?
Oh, I mean, just the the metaphor behind it, obviously. Also, the creator, Vera, is a friend of mine from Los Angeles. She and I did a showcase together back in 2014. So it's been on my radar for a really long time. But obviously, getting to tell this story through horror, through a metaphor, so it's still sort of, it's approachable, but it also kind of educates people a little bit about, you know, what you went through.
Right.
Right. Which we could, you could do an entire podcast on. So
I
obviously,
can't even. Yeah.
I can't. I'm very apprehensive to go into the depth of.
I was trying to explain what happened. Google this. Yeah. We don't have time. About like the whole Queen Liliuokalani thing. And I was like, I explained it before we got on the podcast. I was like, I can't Google it. It's weird. It's sad.
It's a whole thing, guys. It's a whole
like literal evil fairy tale level stuff.
Yeah.
Talking about like your, obviously, like you have all of this like cultural knowledge and being able to talk about like the way, because that, again, I've talked about this. This is what genre does so well, is that it's right. able to take these huge subjects and make them and process them. And so this episode was written by Liz Alper, who is also a producer. And Liz has said that like it's important when you talk about especially like these culturally important episodes that you have culturally authentic casting. And for this story to have actual Native Hawaiians to be represented correctly. So how were you able to draw on that background as someone who was from Hawaii and from Maui specifically to portray the role of Leilani in this episode?
Wow. That's a big question.
It is.
But I'm going to try to answer it my best. And I have to credit Liz because from the get-go, you know, asked me so much about like, does this word work? And does this work? You know, all of the cultural things. But I guess it was such an experience to bring something that's so inherently close to me. This is me. This is my culture. This is where I'm from. And get to bring it to my experiences into this script. And also, I will say, I got to bring my mainland self to it because
right.
this character was based in Hawaii, had family in Hawaii, but was now living on the mainland.
Right.
And as you know, which is why I chose not to use an accent because typically I have like a pigeon accent. You know what I mean?
I was going to say, I can hear in your voice, there's a slight difference than the character that you portrayed.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a subtle choice. I love that.
Oh, I miss pigeon. Anyway, sorry.
Right?
So wait, let's get into the character a bit because I even though we knew each other socially, I didn't know you grew up in Hawaii or lived there for, an extended period of time. So let's get into like the character of it all, right? So what did you think drove Leilani? Like, how'd you find your way into the character?
I would say probably family, friends. That's a huge deal in Hawaii. You know, mm-hmm. it's everything. Everything mm-hmm. is friends and family. Everything mm-hmm. is family guilt if you don't show up to a party or
I'm Catholic, so I get it.
So it a lot of that was just based off of that and that impetus to like,
and then, she's an activist, right?
Like, yeah, she's an activist. I thought a lot about the activism in Hawaii when I first kind of started developing this character, and then how do I modernize that, and how do I also just make it me?
Yeah.
I've done activism before and I've never really felt like someone who is like super, super hardcore about it, but more like, hey, I don't know what's going on, but I feel like something's not right kind of thing. And I feel like I'm a little bit more of an exploratory activist, I guess to say. Right. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
In that I don't know everything, but I'd like to be here to help kind of thing.
Yes.
Because I'm just, that's just the way I kind of am.
I feel like a lot of people are the same way, and like we're not experts, but we know that we want to do something to be on the right side. So do you think Leilani was more like you in that sense, or do you think she was like, I've read all the studies, activist kind of thing, you know?
I think she was probably more of a studies kind of gal. I think she on the page seemed super, you know, educated about what was going on in her neighborhood, knew everybody in the neighborhood, you know.
Love that. I'm going to fangirl for just a second. Like I said before we started the interview, you did such an incredible job in this episode. Like, you had all the shades. You were so warm. You were so terrified. You did the, my favorite, I call it the movie star teardrop, where just like one single tear like rolls off your beautiful face into the grass. Like,
it's,
I was
so
crying.
Gorgeous. So, and look, and I like the snot. I love when people do the snot. I am here for the snot, but I'm also like, oh, a single tear.
But you gotta give respect when you see the teardrop. So we heard from production that this was your first lead role. Congratulations. How incredible. You. And so what was the difference being the first name on the call sheet? How did that change your approach? How did you feel walking onto set? Talk us through what that experience was like.
Oh, gosh. Being number one on the call sheet, which is something I'd never done before. It made me just realize, and I have to thank the first AD as well, because it just makes you realize like how much of a team sport this all is. And like, if I'm not on my game, everybody else doesn't get to go home. Everybody else can't get to their children on time. Like, pull it to, you know, whatever you do, pull it together, work for this team. Yeah. It makes you think about it. Coincidentally, it made me think about more than myself.
You stepped into a leader role, you feel
right? You step more into that. And then, of course, you know, naturally, I think, you know, you're very aware of your behavior. You're very aware of, like you said, Megan, being a leader and making sure all of your castmates have what they need from you, and you know, the back and forth of that. Leanne and I were always in kind of close communication about what we needed. She was so sweet in that regard, especially when we had like those major, like, spoiler alert, fight scenes, like the bat and the real bat and the fake bat came in and all of that stuff.
You were working with the director of the episode, Albert Shin. So talk to us a little bit about that. Like, how did the two of you work together to approach your scenes?
Albert's amazing. He's so easygoing when it comes to that kind of stuff. Like, he'll tell me what's going on. I sort of just put it through my filter and then we go from there. Honestly, he was really easy to work with. And I do need to brag about this a little bit. We got done an hour early every day.
Yo, that's wild.
Got our shots in.
Hire this woman every other show immediately. She'll shoot you out early.
We will get our day in. We will finish the day. But yeah, Albert his approach was super simple. Like, I think he trusted me to know that, like, I knew what the given circumstances were in that moment. And I think he trusted that I was going to figure it out. And then if not, he would just come and tell me. You know, I worked seamless. I felt like we worked seamlessly. I hope he feels the same way. I think he does. But yeah,
that's awesome. Simpatico. Yeah. So let's talk about how the psychological horror of this episode. So it gets into the violent history of the U.S. toward we can say Native Hawaiians, but Danielle, what was the, you had a term that was more.
Oh, well, I use the term local. That's like a different, that's more of like a an islandy thing. Because obviously it's Hawaii, there are Native Hawaiians, and I'm not like an expert. But so local is kind of like a term for all of the different Pacific Island and other folks who were brought over to the island and kind of mixed and meld and became this beautiful, you don't want to say melting pot, mixing bowl of culture on the island, because people were brought over for the different, whether they were here on purpose or because on purpose, meaning they wanted to be, or whether they were here because they didn't want to be on the different plantations. And so local is kind of like the term that folks use. Does that feel right? Or am I don't want to.
It feels very right.
Overstep.
See, I have no idea. And I love hearing that because, like, yeah, there's a difference between the people who, you know, originated on the island, but it's also different than somebody who's colonizing it and somebody who was brought over against their will and is now now a native, or, you know, right, a loco of the island. Local, so yeah, thank you for that perspective. So that's yeah, what the psychological horror is about. Mm-hmm. You know, the gentrification of sacred land, outlawing the Hawaiian language, and other attempts to mm-hmm, erase them from their culture and history, and like mm-hmm, replace it with a big name resort that has no care for the culture or history of the place. So for you, Mapuana, were there any specific artistic choices you decided to make to like convey that feeling that this is family, that this is a community under attack from these outside forces?
I was thinking about it the other day about, you know, one of the things that I felt colonizing does first is take away language. And I was like, that's so crazy, because it's like, that's the way you think. So if you stop thinking in your native tongue, then it almost like dilutes your thought processes. And then who are you? And then you start to lose your identity because of that, right? Mm. I myself don't speak Hawaiian. And I know that that's, I don't know if that's a sort of what happened with the generations of Native Hawaiians.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my dad is Puerto Rican, and he used to dream in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And he grew up speaking Spanish, you know, but he also speaks English fluently because it's a Commonwealth. So that erasure of language is really interesting. And was there anything like physically that you were aware of, because the erasure in this is, you know, spoiler, everybody go watch it, made literal. So did that affect your performance in that way?
All I can say is that I think we have been living as, you know, Hawaiians have been living with this sort of this cultural split for a really long time now. Mm-hmm. I was watching this Eddie Aikau documentary, and this guy was one of his brothers was talking about how like the hotels started to come up, and like how, you know, they sort of got pushed away, and he started crying because he was like, it was clear that they didn't want us there. And that made me so sad. And so he was like, and so we went to the water, and that's how we, you know, sort of preserved our culture there, by surfing and, you know, going there because nobody wanted them anymore.
Obviously, like we're getting into this topic of gentrification, and there is so much, there's so much that goes with when you talk about that, because there is this other family that moves into Leilani and Koa's home, right? And so, like, technically, you could say, and like put all of the quotation marks around it that you can hear in my voice, technically, you can say, like, they're not at fault. Technically, they're just people who wanted to, like, buy a home that's on the market in a place that they like. But, like, what they're doing is displacing other people, like the people who are from this neighborhood, the people who are from this place. They are, you know, causing harm. So what do you think this episode is saying about the responsibility of people to stand and be like allied to Indigenous folks and Indigenous and Native Hawaiians, and like, you know, the idea that, you know, we have to be responsible and take care of each other?
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that right now.
Yeah,
because
that's okay.
I think currently, you know, there's people buying up a lot of land in Maui right now, and in Oahu and different places, and raising the real estate to like just crazy. And I understand, obviously, it is heaven there. It's paradise. It is one of the most beautiful places to live in the entire world. Mm-hmm. If you had the money, why not buy a bunch of it? Mm-hmm. But you know, with that does... it does displace a lot of people, and it does this weird, and I'm just from an observational standpoint, you know, my home, for instance, is now 6, 7, or 8 times the value that it was when I was a kid. There's no way I'd be able to afford it now. Like, I'm lucky that my father has that piece of land that's in a very regular suburban neighborhood. Yeah. Mm. So I guess I'm sort of answering this through my own experience, because it's such a huge topic.
Can you talk about like why you think this episode was seen through Leilani's lens as opposed to, say, the husband's?
That's an interesting question. And to Liz's credit, she switched it. It was originally
what?
Yeah. Is that like ultimate spoiler? Like it was,
it's awesome it was info.
Anytime, backstage stuff. This is amazing. Keep going. Sorry.
I auditioned for the wife. I auditioned and then it transitioned into it being a female. So
they changed it to be your story after you got the role?
Yeah, they switched it over. They were like, can you read for the husband? So I read for the husband. And I think that switch, I don't know, I think it gives it that sort of more, for me anyway, and I think especially with a daughter, it gives you that sense of the love that's there for a family, the sort of, I'm doing this with my hands, but it's
she's making a scooping motion toward
her heart. I'm making a scooping motion towards my heart. And that's the word that I think I'm trying to express, that we have that as Hawaiians, right? We have such a deep love for each other, for our culture, for all, you know, and I think that from getting to be in the female perspective of that gives it a little more softness maybe before we get into the contrast of how harsh everything really is, which I think heighten the stakes of the story personally.
Oh, this is, I'm sorry. Like, I don't mean to like blow up our own ass, but God, this is what I love about Two Sentence Horror Stories. It's like they find those things and they find people where they go like, we should make this about you. So Mapuana, this has been so good. This was amazing. Oh. Thank you so much for taking your time and chatting with us. Please let us know what stories are you telling next? What are you up to? And I know that some things are like NDA, but tell us what you can.
No, I can. Season 2 of Doogie Kamealoha MD has been picked up.
Yay! And that's a show on
Disney Plus.
Yes.
Disney Plus.
It's very cute.
So again, I get to tell more Hawaiian stories and just continue the path on that. And I have to say that I'm so grateful for this shift that we're having and we're experiencing right now, that we're talking on a podcast that has a show that's talking about Hawaiian issues, all of these things. Like, I know that there's a lot of very deep things and topics that we discussed, but the light about it is that we are discussing it and we're opening these conversations, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I just think it's, this is the other part of me, I guess, that's maybe the activist that's like, woohoo, because I'm like, we're talking about it. At least we're talking about it. 10 years ago, we weren't even talking about
it. Yo, sunlight disinfects, yo.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So. And telling stories is a great way to call people in, as we say, joy of the difference as opposed to calling people out. So,
and that's the most important thing to me, Megan, and the most important thing I think around, you know, all of the things that we discussed here is I hate that gap in between. Storytelling gets to bring us together so we can talk together and we can go through this awkward mess together of, you know, what's appropriation, what's this, what's that, and we can somehow come to understanding each other, because that's I think what we hopefully at the end of the day want to get to.
Yes. And thank you, Mapuana, for bringing us a little bit closer to these stories. And thank you for taking the time to sit down with us today. It was such a pleasure to have you.
I could talk to you both forever, really. Thank you.
Danielle, what an incredible conversation with Mapuana. I loved her insight. I loved her point that we keep making every podcast about the cool thing about genre is the ability to bridge the gap, right, between, you know, political discourse and storytelling. And it's like through these fun conventions that we draw people into our point of view.
Yeah, and also just like listening to her talk so much about, because I do feel like Hawaiian culture is so unique and so special. And people just think of like, you know, leis and luau's and like all, but like there is so much about, gosh, and I don't want to insert myself into it, but like there's so much that she talked about like what's happening in Hawaii and like the way the Hawaiian culture is being affected by things outside of it that a lot of people like don't know. And she's so smart and so talented and so funny. This was really an amazing conversation. I would have her back to talk about literally anything. I could listen to her talk about, I don't know, Hamilton for like an hour.
Well, it was cool for me to hear this perspective on Hawaiian culture from both Mapuana and yourself. Learned a lot and I love it. So coming up, we're joined by writer-producer April Wolf. Well, April, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Honestly, like we're literally so pumped to have you. You're so dope. You did dope things. And we love all of the dope things that you do.
Well, I like both of you quite a bit. So the love is all mutual.
Great. I'll write that in my journal later when I'm feeling sad.
Yeah, let me keep that on me forever.
So a little behind the scenes intel for our audience. You're a friend to the show. And as Danielle and I know, you love horror. So let's go back to the beginning for all the youths out there. What was the first film that made you a horror fan?
I've talked about this a lot before, but I did used to watch horror quite a bit with my grandparents growing up. And I think that it's a toss-up between Sleepaway Camp and Nightmare on Elm Street, specifically Dream Warriors. Because those were two that I saw when I was really, really young. And they were, you know, nightmare fodder for me for a really long time. Like, I was, like, so terrified of bees. And this is before I saw My Girl.
Oh, my God. that's my first bee trauma.
Yeah. And then, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, the third one had so much awful, awful imagery that was just, like, school related and also like every little bit of like tongue tying on the bed, all of that. It was pretty horrifying for me, and it really stuck with me. I was an insomniac when I was a kid, and I'm sure part of it had to do with like the trauma of how I grew up, but part of it was having to do with the fact that I would always think of, I always thought that Freddy Krueger's like fingers were gonna like curl around like the side of the bathroom door from the hallway where like my bed faced, so I could see it. So I would just sit there reading the Bible trying to fall asleep.
Oh wow. Sleepaway Camp was one of my first ones. Obviously now I look back and I'm like, ah, I love it, but it's problematic and it's super weird. But also like so it wasn't that one, it was Nightmare on Elm Street 4. Was very much like, that was the one where I learned that I had to read when I was eating, because if I didn't, I would only think of Freddy eating people's heads as meatballs on pizza.
Oh, yeah.
But also absolutely. Alice is also that bitch. Alice is my final girl. So whatever. Alice is that bitch. Yeah. I'm sorry. Like it's, I have very strong opinions.
I
got
to jump
this.
In on the Freddy Krueger of it all, because he's the most terrifying to me, because I was also a child insomniac. And so like sleeps and dreams and nightmares, like people are like, do you watch horror movies give you nightmares? I was like, no. I had nightmares. So I watched horror movies because there was nothing worse than what was already in my brain. And it was a terrifying idea to me that those awful dreams could come true. So just the concept of Nightmare on Elm Street set me back years.
Oh God. Yeah. And I'm actually reading a book of interviews of Wes Craven's that was put out by a university press. And that's how you know it's a mark of quality, because those people are like fact checking. They are like, it is
name
like
studious.
Yeah. So, I'm actually reading that right now, and it just gives me a whole new appreciation of the work that Craven was doing leading up to that movie and why he even did it in the first place.
Okay, so like we love Wes Craven here. So what was it about Nightmare on Elm Street that like really like the themes, the characters, soundtrack, like what was it that really got you into it? We're all not sleepy babes. We don't sleep. I've talked to all of us about this. We don't sleep. But so what was it about that movie that really like drew you in and like connected you to horror?
You know, it's something that I'm not sure that I was conscious of when I was watching it when I was a kid. I mean, like we don't really think about that until later on. And then we're kind of like retro, you know, spectively thinking like, oh, maybe that's why. Yeah. And reading this book of interviews, I think the thing that's really interesting for me is that he's talking about being an evangelical filmmaker. And saying that he was kind of like jealous of the Catholics for kind of cornering the horror market and was just like, you know, I grew up evangelical and we've got our shit too. And, you know, like I would like to, put that on display. And so while Nightmare on Elm Street is not considered to be in any way a religious horror film, it is very much, I think, embedded in this kind of Midwestern Christianity that I grew up in, that feels really oppressive and feels like there's no adults listening to you. You do feel like you're on your own, but there's also some kind of, you know, God and demigod, like kind of fighting over your soul constantly. And so you feel like you are in the midst of some kind of epic battle that you can't even fathom, just from being raised in that environment. And I think that him talking about that in those interviews, it really kind of drives home maybe like the subconscious things that it was getting to me as like that kind of stuff. Cause we can talk all day and night about nightmares just being awful and, you know, the concept of that being so, kind of, resonant for everyone. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think that's what kind of hit my soul.
I'm going to move topics just a bit. So we're talking about like Sleepaway Camp, which is what I would call fun horror. So my fiance goes, let's watch something fun tonight. And I said, define fun. Because to me, there's a certain kind of horror movie that is just fun, that I like get a big kick out of, that doesn't actually scare me, but it's still like, I mean, it scares me, but in like a fun way. So, you know, there's that campy side to horror too, that is so exciting to be a part of. So like Malignant, you know, like I was cackling during Malignant. I was like clapping at these terrible tropes, but seeing them used knowingly, right? So for you, where do you think you fall on the camp scale? If like over here is Malignant and over here is, you know, the Vavitch or Hereditary or something, you know, really indie and serious and disturbing.
I think I fall actually exactly in the middle between those things because I can't help but write kind of serious dramas into my stuff. But then those serious dramas end up usually like those scenes end up being like a Todd Solondz version of them. Yeah. And then I also tend to write a lot of creature effects and things into my stuff. So I love like a good old fashioned creature feature in that sense. And to me, those are kind of closer to what, you know, Megan is calling like the fun side. But there's, I just feel though that anything that I write, as you know, I'm sure that you both feel this way too, that I have to figure out what the why now is of it first. That's, and because that's just like kind of I've always felt this way. And again, it's because I really, when I was convinced when I was younger that I was going to die really young. And so I've always put like a lot of importance on like every single day and like what meaning it has. And it's just like, I was not a fun child, you guys.
but it sounds like you would have been one of my friends. Let's sit over here and talk about serious things.
I used to like sit on the playground and just by myself crying, thinking about death. Like that's where I was at when I was a kid.
So. Yeah.
Baby.
It didn't really end. So I still feel like you have to have like a why now of like, you know, why is this relevant? And it doesn't mean that it has to be like, well, you've got to be talking about today's topics, you know, like ripped from the headlines. Right. It just has to have some kind of meaning beyond the fun. And you know, if you can slip it in sneakily, that's great. Sometimes you can't.
Well, I gotta say, I'm a huge, you know, I was I was fangirling about how I follow you on Twitter, which is such a like disturbing insight into the zeitgeist of the collective consciousness, right?
Oh,
and I feel like the ability to be good at that is sort of what you're talking about, because you're penetrating like the conversation. It doesn't matter if it's related to a news topic, right? You're like, what are people like feeling collectively? Like, that's the exciting part about genre to me.
Yeah. You're supposed to be tapping into some kind of anxiety or fear. And that's what horror movies have done, you know, consistently, is tapping into that collective anxiety of that moment as best as possible. And, you know, often that collective anxiety is just circular. So it just keeps coming back. So then you get the resurgence of the same movie back and forth every 10 years. And you're like, yeah, we feel this way again.
So you did the 2019 Black Christmas remake, which, God, I love. It was so good.
It's so good.
So can you walk us through like the experience of co-writing that movie?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Heavy sigh.
Hard sigh. The hardest of sighs.
Yeah. It was just like, it was about, you know, the whole making of the movie was just like 6 intense months of like Hollywood boot camp.
Oh, yeah.
You know, invaluable lessons learned. There's sanity tested. Too many time zones crossed, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was, it was a lot. And I came on somewhat late in the process, to handle a lot of the script writing duties, because it was a lot for one person to handle as a writer director. And, I took on at some point the brunt of the screenwriting duties for that. And the directive, you know, was something that the Sophia Tikal, the director and my co-writer, that she gave me of the kind of movie that she felt capable of making, and the kind of movie that she would want to make.
That's really interesting, because it's sometimes different, right? Sometimes I feel like I'm writing something that I can write, but I wish I could write X, Y, and Z. So that's really interesting. She had that insight into her own work, right?
I mean, I think that's something that if you're a writer, I write things for myself to direct, but I write, I would say, between 7 to 10 scripts a year that I'm not going to be writing or that I'm not going to be directing. Right. So I know which ones I want and the ones that I feel like I connect to, which speaks to, again, what we were talking about before, which is like, it has to be a really specific kind of like arty meets lowbrow type of thing. Yeah. The rest of the stuff is just like kind of across the board, different genres, all of this other stuff. And then I'll, you know, hand it off to a different director. And when you work with someone who is going to be interpreting your work, like you really have to get to that point where, like, of course your fingerprints are going to be on it, because no matter what, you know, some things are just going to be the way that you write, but you just have to make it so that it's something that this director wants to stick with. It's such a hard job to direct a film, because you're with it through, you know, development, prep, shooting, and then post, and then, you know, marketing and film festivals and all this other stuff. And I just feel like I have to make a director's job as easy as possible by kind of playing to their strengths. So any director that I'm working with, I watch all of their movies first, and then I'm just like, they did this really well. What if I put in a scene like this? Like, here's something that I know that they connect with. And just kind of like working as a psychologist when you're doing it, I'm just like, what could I do?
So I'm going to jump in right here, because were there tropes in the genre that you were trying to sidestep or turn on their head? You know, obviously you're such a genre fan and you have a deep well of knowledge. So which of those were you trying to do? Which do you think made it into the film? Which do you think you wish had made it or like didn't make it?
Well, the tropes thing is funny because like you do have to kind of set out to see what kind of tropes you want to kind of upturn. The first one was the final girl trope that, like, again, I've said this so many times, Carol Clover, love the analysis of this. I get a little bit tired of the final girl. I get tired of like our adherence to having to keep doing this in slashers. It's just like, it just kind of, I don't know, I just get bored sometimes.
Yeah.
So that was something where, you know, I think Sophia and I were in agreement that, like, you know, what if Final Girl is Final Girls? And, you know, just spoilers, but like, not really, you know, whatever. But it's been, the movie's been out for a while.
Yeah, go see her movie.
No, but we should still spoiler. Go see the movie. You have time.
Yeah. Pause this, stream it somewhere and come back. Okay.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's a certain thing that, we were doing with that, where we wanted to turn it like in a very surprising way on its head and be like, oh, this is not at all what I thought it was going to be. You know, I thought we were going to adhere to the rules, and then it's just like, no, those are not the rules anymore. Another thing is we would kind of slyly comment on some of the other tropes. Like we made our main character, she basically, both her parents are dead. She's like, you know, quote unquote orphan, you know, she's in college, but like, she kind of makes a joke about it, you know, cause there's always so much tragedy around her. Just like, oh, both my parents are dead. She's like, she makes a joke about it and just kind of dismisses it. Like, we're not even going to talk about this. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Your
like,
tragic backstory is an offhand joke to me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
This has been so much fun chatting with you, April. Like, we could obviously go on all day. So, please let our audience know what projects you have coming down the pipeline that you're allowed to talk about with us.
I'm like literally not allowed to talk about any of them.
No, it's okay.
So,
it's okay.
It's driving me insane because we're just like waiting on when we can like
announce it,
say anything. But there's a TV show and some movies that people can look out for in a book.
And they can follow you to see anywhere to see you announce those things.
I mean, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can. It's, I don't know if I would recommend it, but I mostly talk about the movies and TV shows that I love, or the things about shows that I watch that I love, because I try to keep things as positive when I talk about you know, the books I'm reading, all that stuff, just kind of turn people on to things. So that's most of what my feed is. And then of course local politics, which, you know, you can mute some of that stuff. It's okay, I get it.
Okay, well, she's being super bashful, but you should actually make sure to follow April Wolf online at awolfful on Twitter. April, thanks again so much. This was fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Danielle, I gotta say, this is one of my favorite episodes because we got to talk to an amazing actor who I know personally, who has achieved one of her dreams, as well as somebody I super admire, who is creating new paths for other voices in horror.
Yo, so we got to talk to, the first actor that we have gotten to talk to on the show, which is amazing, who lent us so much, like not just behind the scenes stuff, which obviously we are super into, but also gave us so much insight into her culture and the way that her culture fed into her performance. So it was like, I don't know, like a 3-in-1. It was amazing. And then obviously getting to talk to a writer, director, podcaster, person who just like knows how this genre works and loves horror and lives it and loves it and loves film, and getting to get their perspective. This was a jam-packed show. I'm like really excited. Also, did we Bechdel?
We
Bechdeled like a whole bunch. Good for us.
Google it, kids, everybody else. You're welcome. Thank you so much to Mapuana Makia and April Wolf for joining us today.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts so you never miss an episode.
Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast is a Stage 13 original series hosted by me, Danielle Radford.
And me, Megan Rosati. Don't forget to watch Season 3 of Two Sentence Horror Stories on the CW and CWTV.com, and stream Seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix.
Check out more on the show at stage13.com and be sure to follow Two Sentence Horror Stories on Instagram at Two Sentence Horror Stories for the latest updates on the podcast and show, and on our Facebook page at Two Sentence Horror Stories to connect with other fans of the show and share your thoughts on this season.